from KCRW. I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. This week, film weapons expert and armorer Brian W. Carpenter offers his analysis of what went so wrong on the set of the Alec Baldwin movie Rust.
Well, the number one is the live round being on set. That never should occur. That would be the worst case scenario, is to introduce a live round, a live bullet, onto a movie set that's using firearms. Aside from that, there's a litany of mistakes on the side of the props department. Then you move to the fact that the first AD, apparently, and what we're hearing...
Carpenter walks us through the circumstances that contribute to the tragic death of cinematographer Helena Hutchins. And he shares this hope that this nightmare will push the industry to embrace certification and standardized training programs for cast and crew members who handle guns on set. He also explains how what happened on Rust is different from the series of mistakes that led to the 1993 death of Brandon Lee on the set of The Crow. But first, we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So the ongoing story of Rust, which gets worse and worse as we learn more and more, we're talking about gun safety on the show this week, but through a lens of business, you kind of have to say to yourself, what is this movie, which I was told was a $6 million movie, and what is Alec Baldwin doing in this little movie? Many people have asked me that. And this is not the first movie he's made with this set of producers. He did another one called Supercell. And earlier this year, he talked about that with a colleague of mine at The Hollywood Reporter. And he claimed that this was about storm chasers. And he said, yes, it was fun. But he also said that he doesn't want to work. And he has had 6 kids in 7 years. And he doesn't want to, you know, be on a set for a long time. This was a week of work. And my question is, how much of that budget goes to Alec Baldwin? And how much of the litany of trouble comes from a movie with a small budget, which has a name star? And I should stress, Alec Baldwin is not the only one doing this kind of small movie. These are not studio movies. What happened on Rust, I'm completely convinced, would never happen on a big studio movie. These are small movies. They're sold at film markets. That was the case with Supercell. So the question is, how much of this money goes to him, and how much of the lack of money then leads to the crew walking off, citing terrible conditions and unsafe conditions, corner cutting, a 24-year-old inexperienced armorer who had, certainly there were questions raised about her performance on her previous job. All of these things raise the question of, how does this work exactly? How much goes to Alec Baldwin? How much is left over? And what is the game?
And, Alec Baldwin is a producer in name on this film. We don't know what his actual duties were, but, producer can mean many things to many different people, as you know. Does he have any potential liability if he was, quasi in charge as a producer, in addition to being the star of the movie? That's the real question I have going forward here, is the liability issue, because we saw from the sheriff's department this week that they said the investigation can go on for potentially weeks or months. They are not ruling out criminal charges in this case. We saw with the Sarah Jones incident a few years ago, where a production assistant was killed on a train track in Georgia during a shoot. The director of that film actually went to jail for a year based on a criminal plea that he made. So, there was also a civil case in that situation, the wrongful death case brought by Sarah Jones' family, that ultimately led to an $11.5 million judgment. These are some of the things that I think we're going to start to see going forward, is what is the liability here, both criminally and civilly? How far does it extend? Does it go to people like Alec Baldwin? Does it go to the producers that were financing this film? Or will it simply accrue to the assistant director who handed the gun to Alec Baldwin, or the armorer whose job it was to make sure it was safe?
Yeah, the assistant director admitted that he hadn't checked the gun. Alec Baldwin is handed a gun and told it's not loaded. And, then you get to this mystery of, does Alec Baldwin, the actor, would he be expected to know anything about what was going on and have any responsibility? Or maybe not. What about Alec Baldwin, the producer? What does Alec Baldwin, the producer, know? Does he know that half a dozen crew members walked off and what their complaints were? Does he know that these corners are being cut on this production and the crew was very unhappy about what, the housing conditions friends, and in some cases not being offered nearby housing. So they had to risk themselves by driving after very long production days. This has been a huge issue, as you know, in the IATSE negotiation. So untangling that will take months, I think. And ultimately, yes, there's questions about who is liable, and also questions about, you know, there's going to be civil litigation. We know that, as you pointed out, that happened in the previous case. It will happen in this case, I'm sure. And do they have insurance for this kind of thing on this little movie? Or, you know, do they have to go into bankruptcy, these producers? You know, who can survive this kind of thing as a professional? I think those are all questions that we're going to find the answers to.
The worst fact that I've seen so far in this is that there was a text message saying, this is a dangerous set. Something bad is going to happen. Like, to me, that is the first line of a lawsuit when you file. It's like they knew. You know, investigators say they found 500 rounds of different types of projectiles on the set. So clearly there was a lot of weaponry and a lot of activity with guns. And it just seems like that's exactly the kind of situation where you have to have strong leadership to make sure everything is safe at all times.
Yeah, which clearly wasn't. Let me turn to Dune. Dune was a movie that was, as you know, much delayed by the pandemic. Denis Villeneuve, the director, had made it very clear how unhappy he was that Warner's was releasing it a day and date on the streaming service, HBO Max, same day that it opened in theaters. The movie's done, you know, well enough that there is already a sequel that has been approved. But it is a question, once again, as to what happened in terms of the box office, you know, that would not have happened if it weren't streaming the same day that it opened. A lot of people said this is the one you have to see on a big screen. I'm sure a lot of people didn't. Warner's isn't really sharing that. It seems to have been very successful on the streaming service. So it has been deemed worthwhile to go forward.
Yeah, we actually don't know how many people watched it on the streaming service, and Warner's has not provided that information. Anecdotally, a lot of people I know did. I certainly did. But, you know, the calculus here is an interesting one because it's not a traditional box office analysis. First of all, the producer of the movie, Legendary Entertainment, which financed 80% of this film, they were made whole. They were paid off when Warner's decided to put the movie on HBO Max day and date. So they're made happy already. Then you have the box office, which has been okay. You know, ultimately this movie could get to about 300 probably, maybe a little more. And that's fine. It's a $160 million budget. So they are saying that they will hit break even on this. Uh-huh. But then you add it. Yeah, we don't know exactly. But then you add in the HBO Max factor. And, you know, as we've talked about many times in this show, that is the goal of this entire entertainment ecosystem right now, is to boost subscribers to streaming services. And I have a feeling, we don't have any evidence of this, but I have a feeling that Dune was probably pretty successful in that regard, because it is the kind of, you know, genre fanboy sci-fi type project that does lure a lot of the hardcore film fanatics that may sign up for this. But again, we don't know.
Yeah, I think there's been a little bit of, let's say, ruffled feathers, because a lot of the press has been like, this is a Warner Brothers success, when it's really Legendary's movie. And it was Legendary's call as to whether the sequel gets made. And I also think there was a bit of a sticking point. I don't know how they worked it out, but this question of day and date, I guarantee you, was part of that negotiation for the sequel. Did they commit Warner's to say, yes, we will give it the 45-day window? I'm assuming they did, because, you know, as I said, Denis Villeneuve felt very strongly about that.
Well, the interesting thing here also is that when this movie comes out in 2023, there will likely be an entirely different leadership structure at Warner Media, because it's being bought by Discovery. So, you know, the Discovery people could come in and say, yeah, you know, we said 45-day window, but you know what? This is our new strategy, and Dune is going to premiere in theaters and on HBO Max. And, you know, I am betting that either in the Legendary deal for the sequel or in Denis Villeneuve's deal to make the sequel, there will be language in there that guarantees how this movie is released, because he was pissed this last time.
100%. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News. Coming up after a short break, Hollywood weapons expert Brian W. Carpenter explains how cost-cutting can have deadly consequences. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. It may take months to learn all that went wrong on the set of Rust, resulting in the death of 42-year-old cinematographer Helena Hutchins. But already, very troubling information has emerged. The morning of the shooting, half a dozen crew members walked off the set, in part because of safety concerns. The armorer in charge of the weapons was an inexperienced 24-year-old with a questionable track record. The gun that was handed to producer and star Alec Baldwin had misfired before. The first assistant director has now told investigators he didn't properly check that gun before handing it to Baldwin. According to a Santa Fe County sheriff, investigators have now recovered what they believe to be the lethal lead projectile and its shell casing. Authorities also reported finding approximately 500 rounds of ammunition, a mix of blanks, dummy bullets, and live rounds on the set. Brian Carpenter didn't work on Rust, but he raises many questions about what happened based on what we've learned so far. Carpenter spent years working in private security and tactical law enforcement before moving into the film business. He's worked as an armorer, the person responsible for overseeing weapons, on series including Queen of the South and Claws. It's my understanding, though, that there's no official certification for armorers. Am I right about that?
That's correct. In most parts of the United States, there's no certification. California and some of the unions out there have some certifications, and I understand that some of the ones up in the East Coast around the New York area have them. But for the most part, and especially here in the South, which has become a hub for a lot of films, especially the Atlanta, Georgia region, the New Orleans, Louisiana region, there are no certifications in place to vet out any armorer that would get a job on a set.
That seems a little scary, doesn't it? It seems like something that we might need to address.
I have been verbal about that for years, especially working in the space of the real world that I did before I came into film. Anything that you do that is dangerous, could harm somebody, or could cause, if you were complacent or irresponsible or just incapable of doing the job due to lack of experience, you require some type of certification to let others know that those things aren't the case. But when I first came into working as an armorer, that was one of the things that was, I was not anticipating that, let me say that. In the film industry, basically, it was just, you have to know somebody that you call that says, yes, I've worked with that person before, and they can do the job. Aside from that, especially on these smaller shows that may not have those access or resources or don't even reach out to try to do that, it's just everybody's game. If you can talk to the right person and convince them that, you need to get paid to do that, then you'll wind up being an armorer.
You were not on the Rusts, involved with Rust, thankfully for you, I guess, but
right.
I'm sure you're following it pretty closely. And as I understand it, you see a list of things, a whole list of things that seem to have been completely not normal. Let's put it that way. Run through some of that for us.
Well, the number one is the live round being on set. That never should occur. That would be the worst case scenario, is to introduce a live round, a live bullet, onto a movie set that's using firearms. Aside from that, there's a litany of mistakes on the side of the props department that appear to not have been followed. Again, I wasn't there, but it appears that if you let a gun get out to a set, you have bypassed, avoided, or completely broken at least 6 different checks that should have occurred of that weapon from the time that it was placed into the safe on the props truck initially, assuming they were putting them in a safe, to the time that it was removed from that safe, loaded onto that cart, brought out to that set, checked again, and then checked in front of a second verification source on set, so that it's a two-party check system at that point in time. That's on the side of props and armor. Then you move to this fact that the first AD, apparently, in what we're hearing, independently grabbed the weapon, took it off the cart, and handed it to the actor. That's a safety violation. That's not supposed to occur. And then Alec Baldwin pointing the weapon directly at somebody, that's a safety violation.
This issue of pointing directly at a person, I'm unclear at this point. Is he trying to point this at a camera to get a certain shot? Have you been able to figure that out?
Well, here's the thing. Did anyone ever even give Alec an instruction course on safe handling of a firearm? You assume because he's an actor that's been in many things and, you know, professional in his career that at some point in time, hopefully along all the shows that he's done, maybe he went through some type of safety training. But the harsh reality is, yes, it was pointing directly at somebody. And the thing is, no matter what any show looks like, if it looks like they're pointing directly at someone, they're really not. Any professional outfit is going to have an off angle shot. It's set up that way so that you're never pointing that weapon at anyone. If they're wanting to fire directly at camera, then in that case, the camera is generally locked off and remote operated. No one's behind it. And that's just a safety precaution. Again, we're talking about blanks. We're not even considering the fact that there will be a live bullet in it. We're still talking about blanks. You do all this just to go four times over what's necessary for safety precautions, just to make sure a blank wouldn't hurt anybody, which generally doesn't do any damage to anyone over a few feet. A blank can only generally kill at very close ranges, and that's within a few inches where the concussion actually would kill. Like the actor that put the gun to his head and pulled the trigger and the concussion killed him many years
ago. Mm-hmm. So you would suspect that there was a bullet in the gun, or we don't know yet?
Well, that's what everyone is saying happened, that a live bullet made it into the gun. I'm not trying to armchair quarterback. I'm certainly not trying to be an investigating body on this. But some of my colleagues asked me, they said, what do you really think happened? I said, the only thing that I can remotely think that would happen was if they went out and were live firing these guns at some point, which, by the way, is a safety violation. So I said, maybe that could have occurred. And, you know, now some of the information coming out is that they may have even went out just target shooting, like plinking with these weapons. On their brakes, which is just pretty hard to believe. But that would...
Well, I should note that that's not a verified thing at this time. We don't, as we're speaking, we don't know. But I guess the bottom line is it's hard for you to fathom a situation where...
That's right. More live bullet got there.
I mean, we had seen the Brandon Lee tragedy where I don't know what got into that gun. Maybe you have a better recollection of it than I do, but...
Sure. In that particular circumstance, that was just the best word would be just a series of terrible, unfortunate events. The day before, the revolver that they were using that was being pointed at Brandon Lee was loaded with dummy rounds. Dummy rounds are bullets that look and simulate the look of a real bullet, but they're not real. In other words, they have a projectile on the top of it, but the casing has no gunpowder in it, and the primer, which detonates the gunpowder, has been removed. And BBs are put inside of it, so you can shake that because it looks very real, and you need to be able to pick it up and physically and audibly hear those BBs shake so that you know it's not real, it's a dummy round. Well, those things were loaded into the cylinder of the revolver, and as they were taping, the actors pulling the trigger, and they said they heard a loud pop, like pop, not anything like a gun going off, but a pop. Mm. Now, an experienced person would have probably picked that up as a primer was still left in one of those casings. So in other words, the dummy rounds were not made properly. One of them had a hot primer still left. Well, that was just enough pressure to push that projectile out of the casing and into the barrel just a little bit. Now, they should have stopped there when somebody heard that, but that they didn't do that. Safety violation 234. Then when they got ready to wrap that scene, they should have checked that weapon in between scenes to shine a flashlight down the barrel and look into the cylinder, make sure there were no obstructions. Apparently, that didn't happen either. The gun went up into its storage area. When it was brought back out the second time to film the rest of the scene from a turnaround shot, they loaded it with blanks. Now, blanks are rounds that have gunpowder to simulate the sound and the blast and the fire and all of that, but have no projectile. They should have checked that weapon multiple times then. They did not. No one looked down the barrel. So now you've got the projectile lodged in the barrel and now a blank loaded into the cylinder. So you've effectively put together a live bullet again. The pressure from the blank drove the projectile that was lodged in the barrel out at enough feet per second that it struck Brandon Lee and killed him.
That is a series of, as you say, apparent clear safety violations, and yet, you know, very fluky in a way, too.
I know, right? This is something totally different. This, what is apparently occurred here on Rust, is something totally different than that. This was strictly what appears to be a live bullet, just a bullet that you would go, that someone would go hunting with, or they would go out on the range and shoot with, or any, back in the 1800s, they would have used it for self-defense. It was just a live round loaded into that gun and discharged.
That's the how it appears, yeah. I mean, the young woman who was the armorer on this was 24 years old. Her father, I guess, is very well known in the field.
Right. I know her father professionally. I do not know her. I'm not sure what her level of expertise or training was. I'm not trying to age, you know, youth shame someone, but usually, you know, it's a lot of years. I mean, even in the real world area, before you can, you know, be a handler, operations team, you know, leader, or take charge of a lot of levels of safety, you have to have a lot of years under your belt before you do it. And usually under the tutelage of someone who has a lot of years under their belt to do it. Mm-hmm. Again, not saying that she did or did not have any of these skills, but I'm just saying what generally is required to, you know, safely run a set, especially with a lot of strong personalities in place. And that includes, you know, studio voices, producers, and even actors. You know, you have to know to be soft-handed and be able to be respectful and understand how to work on an active set and the nuances to go along with that. But at the same time, you have to know when to say, no, we can't do this. This is unsafe. I've given you options here. And, you know, this is, it just can't be done this way.
Yes. You've read, I'm sure, as I have, that there were other issues with gun discharges on the set, which clearly would be, especially in retrospect, of course, a huge red flag, especially to somebody like you. And then the crew, the IA crew members walked off in the morning and lots of complaints about safety. It just feels like everything was, you know, contributing to a terrible outcome. I don't know if you had been on that set and you saw these kinds of issues with the crew, what would you have done?
You know, I have nothing against whatsoever and have worked with, you know, people that have done independent or lower budget shows. But a lot of my colleagues only work on tier three shows or, you know, studio shows, major studio shows. And they do it because those particular productions generally, even though they, you know, are subject to trying to cut costs in areas they maybe should not, definitely the lower budget ones most unfortunately regularly do. So if this had been a major production, large studio show, the minute those complaints had been filed or even brought to the attention of anyone, they would have brought all the department heads together that were involved in it. And there would have been a sit down talk about what's going on here. What was the actual reason these safety violations occurred? Are they legitimate complaints? And if so, we will need to address them before anything is moving forward. That's what I would have done.
And on a smaller budget movie, there's just not only no way to do that, maybe, but many, many pressures to keep rolling no matter what.
Well, that's a good way to put it. And at the end of the day, it's the dollars and cents thing. And, you know, everyone talks about the superficial aspect of all of this, you know, which is terrible. And it's a tragedy. And it's a series, as I said, not just one thing. A series of safety violations that led to what occurred in the tragic death of Helena and the director being wounded, et cetera. But the underlying thing here, the deeper water that you don't see, is the fact that these studios are motivated to cut corners because they don't want to spend their monies on personnel that they think they may could avoid. And it's really hard to cut a corner on a camera, and it's really hard to cut a corner on, you know, talent and things of that nature. But if the prop master says, hey, I need an armorer out here today, and the studio says, okay, well, how much is their hourly rate, et cetera? And they're like, oh, can't you just do it? And can't you just pull double duty? And I have multiple times and even recently had that been told to me. I've had prop masters call me and say, hey, I've got a show coming up. I'd like to have you out here. I said, okay, great. Then they call back and say, hey, studio now wants us to, wants me to pull double duty. Prop masters have enough on their plate to begin with without having to handle weapons as well, no matter how skilled they may be. And it requires absolute attention to detail to make sure that things are done safely in that world. And, you know, at the end of the day, those corners being cut and that money being saved was bad enough before COVID. But now with COVID and all the COVID restrictions and all the COVID monies that are being spent on testing and personnel, et cetera, now it's even worse than it was before.
Mm. One of the things that had also been reported is that the first AD who handed the gun to Alec Baldwin and said it was a cold gun, not loaded, he had been apparently fired from a previous production. I don't know what kind of vetting went on. I mean, I'm sure you probably don't either, but I guess your position would be, fired or not, he shouldn't have been touching that gun.
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, the AD should never have walked over and taken a gun off of an armor's weapon off of their cart or a weapon of any of their cart and handed it off to an actor without an armorer present or the prop master present or somebody that was in charge of that weapon. He shouldn't touch it. Number one, you got an issue with why was the cart sitting there without anybody watching it? But there's an issue to where, okay, let's just say hypothetically the armorer had to walk off and go to the bathroom or something of that nature. Well, you have to have a fire watch. You have to have somebody watching that cart that's part of the props department that can stop somebody from reaching and grabbing or touching that equipment. I prefer to have a locking cart where if I have to even turn my back for a moment, I can lock that equipment if I don't have anybody watching it that I trust or that's part of my crew. But in any circumstance, the first AD independently taking it upon himself to go over there and take the weapon off the cart and hand it off to the actor is just, in any professional sense, not acceptable.
So who hands the gun to Alec Baldwin in the ideal situation?
It would either be the armorer or a props master who's cross-trained as an armorer.
Of course, this is a smaller movie, and I don't think there's a lot of experience all in terms of the producers, other than Alec Baldwin, who, you know, when an actor is a producer, you're never quite sure what that means.
Right, right.
We're going to find out more about that. We have had, you know, as you know, the IA had negotiated a deal that is awaiting. The members are either going to approve or disapprove. Do you think this accident, you know, with the crew members being mistreated and walking off who were union, do you have any sense from your, you know, other people in IA that this might affect how they feel about whatever is proposed by the union?
Sure. I mean, you've got, but then again, it boils down to the lower tier shows, you know. We're talking about all of these contract negotiations are happening at a level that's generally higher than what, and I'm trying to say this delicately because I don't want to shine any negative light on an independent film or anything that is of a lower budget tier. So I think that, yes, any crews that work on those shows, you know, feel that they need to be treated as well, both especially with safety, as they are with just general treatment on set, from their meals to their breaks in between work days.
Well, hopefully this is a wake-up call for the industry.
You know, until it always takes a tragedy, unfortunately, before things change. And I said this, if nothing else comes out of this horrific event, if maybe people look a little bit harder, dig a little bit deeper and say, you know what? Safety is everyone's concern and we need to do what's right here and put these minimum safety standards in place and make it, you know, across the board in the film industry. And that helps everyone from the major studios that are producing all the way down to the independent studios that may not even know, but they know one thing, if they go to hire an armorer and they can see that certification and they have their actor who's been through a safety training class, they can look at that because that's going to be in black and white.
Armorer Brian W. Carpenter is the founder of Dark 30 Film Services. Thank you, Brian. It was very, very illuminating.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help this week from Paul Smith, who also mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.